to the nuclei of all atoms. The nucleus of the simplest atom, the hydrogen atom, is just one proton. These beams of protons were accelerated in opposite directions, going round and round across the border millions of times, to the highest energies ever reached in our laboratories, 3.5 trillion volts. If that number doesn't mean anything to you, it's the energy that is given to an electron by having 2 trillion flashlight batteries in series with each other. But that's not how they do it. Protons are accelerated by radio waves, which they ride like surfers riding ocean waves. Of course, you don't want them to plow into the walls of the tunnel. They have to be keep going round and round so they can get up to higher and higher energy. And this is done with magnetic fields, whose strength is some 10,000 times the Earth's magnetic field. These two beams, which are going in opposite directions, at 4 locations around the tunnel, are steered to collide with each other. And in the collisions, when they collide, hundreds of millions of collisions are going on in a second. I can give an idea of the amount of information being produced. It's something like 100 trillion bytes per second of data. Most of it has to be thrown away. There's no way of storing that much information. And so online computers decide what's coming out that's interesting. Now, of course, the thing that's interesting is the production of new kinds of matter. I'm going to use just one equation in this talk, which you've heard of, E equals mc squared. In order to produce a certain mass m, you need an energy E, which is given by m times the speed of light squared. And the kind of new particles that we can produce is limited, therefore, by the energy we have available. This facility, as I said, is called the Large Hadron Collider. The word hadron, perhaps, is unfortunate, could just as well be called the Large Proton Collider. Hadron is simply a collective name for the class of particles, including the particles inside atomic nuclei, and various other particles that feel the strong forces that hold particles together inside the nucleus. Collider, well, it's called a collider because the beams collide with each other. The reason for them colliding, rather than just having a beam hit a stationary target, is that then no energy is wasted in recoil. All the energy is available to create new kinds of matter. And finally, it's called the Large Hadron Collider because it's large. It's large in a number of ways. For one thing, although I don't know the precise figure, the cost of the accelerator and the detectors, which found this new particle, is somewhere approaching $10 billion. And it's big in human terms also. Some 3,000 physicists signed each of the two papers that announced this discovery. They came from over 100 institutions. I noticed that in the first of these two papers, the paper itself was 6 pages. The list of authors was 7 pages. So it's very impressive. It's, you know, just in sheer scale, it's the most impressive experiment ever carried out by science. Still, we should put in perspective what has been achieved. This is not a breakthrough into a completely unexpected new realm of phenomena, like the discovery of radioactivity at the beginning of the 20th century. Just the reverse. This is, as Dr. Yu said, this is a particle that we've been expecting for some 45 years. But it's more than just another particle. It's the last unobserved piece of our current theory that describes all the particles and forces we know about, with one exception, called the Standard Model. Not only is it the missing link, the missing piece of this theory, it is the piece that is responsible for giving all the other elementary particles their mass. Now, I'd like to explain that, and it's, of course, hard. There's this international conference here. I'm going to bore the participants at that conference, and I'm going to mystify everyone else. So you'll have to give me a little leeway. The Standard Model is a field theory. What's a field theory? Well, you know what fields are, because we all experience fields. We're here on Earth in a field, the gravitational field of the Earth. It's what causes apples to fall to the ground. It's from trees. It's what keeps the moon in its orbit around the Earth. It's a familiar part of our experience. There are other fields. Isaac Newton himself, in his last book, pointed out that gravity isn't the whole story. This was Newton's optics. But there are other fields. There are electric and magnetic fields, which Newton already knew about. Magnetic fields, I think most people have seen iron filings attracted to a bar magnet, and have even, holding two bar magnets together, have felt the force of attraction or repulsion between them. Electric fields, electric fields are what are produced when you have changing magnetic fields in an electric generator. They drive the electrons in electric currents through wires. Electric and magnetic fields together produce light. That is, light is nothing but an oscillating field, magnetic field producing an oscillating electric field, which in turn produces the oscillating magnetic field. And it propagates through space at the speed of course, light. The Standard Model is a theory of fields, not just, it leaves out the gravitational field. That's what I meant by the missing element, because that's hard to fit into this framework. But it's a theory of electric and magnetic fields, and a lot of other fields. There's an electron field, and there are various quark fields, and so on. And when quantum mechanics, which is our fundamental theory of physics, describes everything, when quantum mechanics is applied to these fields, we find that the energy and momentum of these fields come in little bundles, which can be recognized as particles. For example, a bundle of energy of the electron field is a particle called the electron. By the way, that's why all electrons in the universe are identical. They all have identical mass, identical charge. It's because they're really all aspects of the same field, the electron field. The bundles of energy of the electromagnetic field are called photons. They are particles of light. Now, as I said, the Standard Model is a theory of various fields, a few dozen fields of various kinds, which are manifested in our laboratory mostly as particles. A central feature of the Standard Model, which gives it its rigidity, which makes it not just a kludge of a messy theory where you adjust the equations to make it come out right and look like an experiment, but is a rigid structure which could hardly be anything but what it is. A central element of the Standard Model are principles of symmetry. Principles of symmetry establish family relationships between different kinds of fields, and hence between the particles, which are the quanta, the bundles of energy, of these fields. So, for example, there is a symmetry that unites electrons, which are familiar in electric currents, with particles called neutrinos, which are nearly massless and have no electric charge. There's also a symmetry that relates the electromagnetic field to another set of fields which carry a different kind of force. This is the so-called weak nuclear force, which, unlike the electromagnetic force, allows particles inside the nucleus to change their nature, to change neutrons into protons or protons into neutrons, and in that way produces the effect we observe as radioactivity, and also the first step in the chain of reactions that gives energy to the sun. Now these family relationships between fields are not something sort of vague, you know, like, well, lions and tigers are sort of similar, and peaches and apricots are sort of similar. These are tight mathematical relationships. And yet, the particles that we observe in the laboratory, which are nothing but the bundles of energy of these fields, don't seem to satisfy these family relationships. For example, the particle of light, the photon, the quantum of the electromagnetic field, has no mass. That's why it travels at the speed of light. Anything that has no mass travels at the speed of light. It is part of a family with three other particles called W plus, W minus, and Z. Z is electrically neutral, which are very heavy. They weigh 80 or 90 times as much as a proton. And yet, they're part of a family, and that's a tight relationship. It's not just a vague similarity. Likewise, electrons and neutrinos are part of the family. How is that possible? I mean, where did this crazy idea of a symmetry come from that is manifestly violated in nature? Who would think of such a thing? It all started with a transformative idea, which goes back to work of Yoichiro Mambu, who won the Nobel Prize for this, and Jeffrey Goldstone in 1960. The idea is that in addition to the fields that we know about because we observe electrons and we observe photons and we observe W particles and Z particles, there are other fields that, unlike those fields, pervade the universe. They're present everywhere. And these fields provide a direction which breaks the symmetries. Now, in a sense, this is nothing new. Well, it's obviously new, but it's not entirely new. We here on Earth live in the gravitational field of the Earth, and so we feel that there's no real symmetry between up and down and sideways. These are really very different in our daily experience. Aristotle, in fact, made a whole theory, which you can read about in his book called Physics, of how heavy things like earth and water want to go down, and light things like air and fire want to go up. The distinction between up and down was built into the laws of nature at the most fundamental level. Well, no one thinks that today. We all think, and in fact this is fundamental to everything we do, that in the laws of nature there's no distinction between up and down. There's nothing that breaks the symmetry between different directions in space. It's just we happen to live near the Earth, and the Earth provides a gravitational field which breaks the symmetry. In the case of the Standard Model, we are talking about a field breaking the symmetry, but it's not a field which sets a direction in ordinary space. In fact, this field, these fields, the kind of fields that were considered, say, by Jeffrey Goldstone, are fields that have no sense of direction in ordinary space. And that's why we all think that the laws of nature don't distinguish one direction from another. But they do point to definite directions in a kind of internal space, which distinguishes electromagnetic forces from weak nuclear forces. It distinguishes electrons from neutrinos. It distinguishes various types of quarks from each other. Also, whereas the gravitational field we live in is created, obviously, by the Earth, and if you go far away from the Earth and spin in outer space, all directions will seem the same. These are fields that pervade the universe. They're not created by the Earth or a bar magnet or any other object. They're just solutions. It's just that the equations that govern the fields have solutions in which these fields aren't zero. And they point in some direction which breaks the symmetry and makes sense of this whole thing. That was a tremendously exciting idea back in 1960. I remember I was a little younger then, and how wonderful it was, because in the previous decade, we had made great progress in applying ideas of symmetry to the physics of hadrons, the physics of strongly interacting particles. And suddenly, because of the idea of broken symmetries, we realized it was possible that there was a lot more symmetry in nature, which explains why the laws of nature are what they are, but that we weren't seeing because the symmetries were broken. Just as for Aristotle, the symmetry between up and down was broken by the field of the Earth. Now, this original work by Goldstone in particular wasn't tied to any particular theory of anything. It was just a mathematical possibility. But it was exhilarating to know that this was possible. Almost immediately, Goldstone, and then more rigorously, Goldstone, Salon, and myself. Salon is Abdul Salam, Pakistani physicist working in London, and I was visiting him that year in 1962, pointed out a serious problem with this kind of picture. That when it seemed to us that whenever you have a broken symmetry in nature, you get massless particles, which would have been observed, and therefore it seemed to rule out this whole possibility. You know, if the theory predicts some particle whose mass is not known, and the particle hasn't yet been observed, you can always say, well, it's too heavy, E equals mc squared, we don't have enough energy to produce it. Wait a while, they'll find it. But if the particle is predicted to have zero mass, you can't weasel out of it that way. zero mass, it doesn't take any energy to produce it. And if it's there, you should have seen it. I can explain to you why this is by a simple example of a broken symmetry. And here I am talking not about the kind of internal symmetry that distinguishes different particles or different forces, but symmetry in space, because that's much more familiar. Consider a circular valley with a perfect circular symmetry, like a perfectly round hat, the brim of a perfectly round hat. If you drop a ball into the hat brim, it'll come to rest somewhere around the hat brim. It breaks the symmetry. There was a complete symmetry between different locations and the ball has to fall in one spot, and then that distinguishes that direction from the other direction. So that's an example in everyday life of broken symmetry. It's really not that different from what you have in the standard model. It's mathematically essentially the same thing. Now, what kind of particles will you have in such a theory? The particles correspond to the different modes of motion of that ball in the brim of the perfectly circular hat. Well, one kind of motion is the ball can roll up and down the sides of the valley. There's a restoring force. It'll roll up and down with a certain frequency. That corresponds to a particle of definite mass. The frequency corresponds to the mass of the particle, if I make this analogy perfect. However, there's another mode of motion of the particle that can just roll around the flat valley floor. There's no restoring force there. Give it a tiny shove, it'll roll all around forever and ever unless there's friction. That corresponds to a massless particle. These massless particles were called Goldstone bosons. Don't worry about the word boson. They're just Goldstone particles. And sometimes they're called nano-Goldstone particles. And it was a disaster. I meant this whole lovely idea that there were lots of symmetries that we just weren't seeing because they were broken had to be abandoned. Then in 1964, the problem was fixed by three different groups of theorists. They were, in the order of their papers, Robert Brouwer, François Englert in Brussels, Peter Higgs in Edinburgh, and Doralnik, Hagen, and Kibble, who were all over the place. And what they showed was that in a certain class of theories, which we were already interested in anyway, which are kind of generalizations of electrodynamics, in which there are several kinds of photons, and the different photons carry the charge that they interact with, unlike ordinary photons, which don't carry electric charge. In this kind of theory, which is called the Yang-Mills theory, suggested, with a particular application which turned out to be irrelevant by Yang and Mills in 1954, in this class of theories, because of subtle effects about the way that special relativity and quantum mechanics work together, which I cannot go into, that there is an exception. That whereas Goldstone would say there is a massless particle corresponding to this motion around the perfectly circular valley floor, perfectly flat valley floor, these authors said, no, this massless particle actually turns into one of the spin states of a map of these, quote, photons. Remember, this is the kind of theory which has a number of particles like photons in it, and gives them a mass. So not only do you not get masses for the Goldstone bosons, the, quote, photons in these theories also become massive. This was a great achievement. It made no headlines. Because, you know, the thing that makes headlines is predicting a particular thing which is then discovered. These authors, and Goldstone and Nambu, were not working in a specific theory. They were doing work that is often the most important in physics, but it's not the kind of thing that people know about in popular writing. They were expanding our intellectual horizons to consider possibilities for future theories rather than suggesting specific theories. There were no predictions and no headlines, but it was a crucial breakthrough. This idea, by the way, this idea is called the Higgs mechanism. And part of the reason for giving the priority to Higgs is because I screwed up. I misread the journal article's dates, and I listed Higgs first in subsequent writing. This was pointed out recently in a book by Frank Close. And I didn't know it until I read it in that book. The first paper was actually by Robin on the lab after all these years. Anyway, in 1967, shortly after, independently, Abdus Salam used the Higgs mechanism together with a Yang-Mills theory of weak and electromagnetic forces, and produced what has become the part of the standard model that deals with weak and electromagnetic forces. It unifies the electromagnetic force, which is familiar in everyday life, with this weak nuclear forces that produces radioactivity and the energy of the sun. In this theory, in addition to the force-carrying fields, like the electromagnetic field and its siblings, and in addition to the fields of matter particles, like electrons and neutrinos, there were four additional fields that Salam and I introduced. These are called scalar fields. I think I used that word before, meaning they don't have any sense of direction in space, but they provide a direction in an eternal space which distinguishes electrons from neutrinos and weak forces from electromagnetic forces. In accordance with the Higgs mechanism, three of them get used up, giving mass to the particles that carry the weak force. And that's what breaks the symmetry between the W, the Z, and the photon. That's how the W and Z got so heavy, and the photon remained light. And the fourth particle is just left over. It doesn't get used up in this way, and it's like the mode where you roll up and down the side of the valley. Goldstone had nothing to say. Well, actually, Goldstone, in his work in 1960, actually had that mode, which corresponded, as he recognized, to a massive particle. But nobody paid much attention because it wasn't a specific theory, it was just a general class of theories. In the standard model, this fourth scalar field has quanta, which are actual physical particles, and these are the predicted Higgs bosons. So that's how you know the Higgs boson was predicted. All the properties of this particle are predicted by this theory, except its mass. And it's sort of interesting why mass is not predicted. The mass of the Higgs particle is not predicted by the theory because, according to the theory, all the other particles, which are siblings of things which are massless, get their mass by the breaking of the symmetry which is caused by the Higgs boson. I mean, for instance, the electron and the neutrino. The neutrino has essentially no mass. The electron gets a mass, even though they're siblings, because the Higgs field, just as the gravitational field distinguishes up and down, and actually gives an energy to things you push up. You know, something high up has energy which can be released by dropping it, as you must have noticed. So in the same way, the Higgs field, which doesn't establish a direction in ordinary space, does establish a direction in this internal space whose axes are electron and neutrino, and makes the electron have energy that the neutrino doesn't have. It's really quite similar. And that's why the Higgs mass isn't predicted, is because It's the Oort mass, it's the mass that determines all the other masses. If the Higgs mass was twice as big, the electron would be twice as heavy. And all the other elements. By the way, I've been using the word elementary particle as if we really knew what that meant. We do have a working definition of what we mean by an elementary particle. An elementary particle is just a particle that is the quantum of energy and momentum of one of the fields in the standard model. So electrons are elementary, neutrinos are elementary, photons are elementary, quarks are elementary. Everything else isn't elementary. Protons and neutrons consist of quarks. Nuclei consist of protons and neutrons. Atoms consist of nuclei and electrons. Molecules consist of several atoms, and so on. You and I consist of lots of molecules. None of us are elementary, but the elementary things are the particles which are the quanta of the fields of the standard model. And all of them get their mass from the symmetry breaking which is produced by the Higgs boson. The Higgs boson doesn't produce the symmetry breaking. The Higgs boson is a kind of debris left over from the symmetry breaking. They get their mass from the symmetry breaking, and the Higgs boson is what's left over from the symmetry breaking. Well, I've been talking as if we know that the particle discovered at CERN is the Higgs boson of the standard model in its simplest form. There are alternatives. There are more complicated versions of the standard model. All of them share the fact that there are these deep symmetries and that they are broken. But they differ in particular in the details of how the symmetries get broken. The simple picture that Salam and I used, that there are just four of these fields, three of which get used up giving mass to the W and Z, and the fourth is the Higgs particle, that simple picture is not the only one which could possibly work. One possibility is there aren't four, there are eight. And it has to be a multiple of four for reasons I won't go into. And if there are eight of these, then you would have five left over after you take off three. And there would be five things you could call Higgs particles, two positively charged, a negatively charged, and three neutral, or even more. That's the simplest generalization. Another possibility is called the little Higgs idea, and that is that the Higgs particle is actually a Goldstone boson of an approximate symmetry. I won't go into that. Another possibility that Leonard Susskind of Stanford and I independently suggested in 1979 is that the symmetry is broken, but not by fields that you add to the theory, but is broken by strong forces among a class of particles that feel these forces. This makes the theory very similar to the theory of superconductivity.